This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
It's the question politicians in Canberra ask themselves a lot. Can a government department be successfully relocated from the city to a regional town? We will talk decentralisation in just a moment. And for the love of beer, good food and good company, three mates pack in retirement to open up a country pub.
If you take the pub out of the town, it doesn't kill the town, but the town lacks something from that day on when it's shut. There's less people pulling in, pulling out, and it just doesn't affect us. It'll affect every other business in town as well.
More from those guys in the West Australian Wheatbelt living out their dream. I'm Bridget Fitzgerald, and this is Australia Wide. Barnaby Joyce's plan to move the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority to Armidale in his electorate of New England appears to have failed. The news broke yesterday that a quarter of APVMA staff have refused to move to the regional New South Wales town. So the Canberra office will remain open. It's raised the question once again of whether decentralisation can work. Well, a year ago, a government committee was set up to look into just that. Select Committee on Regional Development and Decentralisation has spent a year visiting country towns and it's just tabled its report, Regions at the Ready. Federal Member for Murray, Damien Drum, is the committee chair. Mr Drum, what did you look at in this report?
We went to every state, we went to all the territories, effectively, we were flying the flag for a decentralisation policy, asking the regions, obviously, would you be ready for a government agency if one was prepared to move and one was able to move with high outcome production into your region? And obviously, the answer was a resounding yes. Every area we went to was very, very keen on the idea of government agencies moving out of Canberra, moving out of Melbourne, Sydney, and being located in regional Australia. So that was, I suppose, the flagship of the inquiry, but it then moved very quickly on to, well, what are the drivers that are going to make that happen more and more? And those drivers are mainly based around connectivity. We need good roads, we need good rail structures, both in passenger rail and also in freight rail. We need connectivity in relation to mobile phone coverage and good NBN, we need good internet broadband. So we need all this connectivity so that businesses can move out into the regions, so that people are relaxed about moving out and yet they still feel totally connected to their friends and their families and to the professionals that they need for their everyday lives.
Because keenness is one thing, but unfortunately we have seen this week that a very high-profile example of decentralisation, which was Barnaby Joyce's moving the APVMA from Canberra to Armidale, appears to have failed, at least in part, considering the Canberra office will have to stay open for purely the reason that people didn't want to move. If you can offer those connectivity advantages in those regions and if you can spend that money, how do you draw the people from the cities out to the country?
It's a combination of moving parts of agencies and moving whole agencies together. So I think, yes, there is a certain amount of pushback in the APVMA move to Armidale. We also went to Orange and we were able to see there in the middle of New South Wales, 20 years ago they moved and State Department of Agriculture was moved from Sydney out to Orange. And at that time there was enormous pushback by the bureaucrats and the public servants who didn't want to live in Orange. Now there's some 600 people working within the Department of Agriculture. It is seen as a stunning success. So we have to acknowledge that even the most stunningly successful decentralisation moves in the future, at the time of having to make the move, there's always going to be pushback.
Damien Drum, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for your interest. Bye-bye.
Dr. Amanda Walsh is the Associate Director of Government Relations at the Australian Catholic University. She's also the author of one of the 196 submissions that this committee received. I spoke with her earlier today. Dr. Walsh, people that live in regional Australia might be a little bit tired of hearing about government consultation. There's lots of reports written all the time about making the economies there better. Should they feel any differently about regions at the ready?
Look, I think that people in regional Australia and people who are concerned about regional Australia should be cautiously optimistic on the basis of this report, yes.
And why is that?
Look, I think the report has managed to sidestep a lot of those perennial problems of inquiries into regional development and even policy making for regional development. By that, I mean that the politicking was really left behind by this committee, which in itself is an achievement. I mean, often cross-party committees will get bogged down in the politics of particular issues. So there was a huge potential there for this to just get bogged down. And the fact is they managed to take a really good hard look at what they term the mega trends that are confronting regional communities and to actually come up with some viable and very strategic approaches for regional Australia and regional policy.
One of the most eye-catching of those recommendations was that this report could pave the way for a white paper for regional Australia. What would that involve?
I have a personal interest in this because that was a recommendation that I made to the committee, that it's high time for a white paper on regional Australia. Now, what it would look like, obviously, would be a matter for the government of the day, should this government or a future government choose to take up that recommendation. But most white policy processes follow a pretty similar pattern, and that is that initially a committee will be formed, you know, a panel of experts, a green paper will be produced, which is essentially a high-level discussion paper to guide consultation, and then the consultation will begin. And I know we've just been through a consultation process with this select committee that's produced the report, but I think the significance of the white paper goes beyond just the consultative process. I was really keen to see a white paper for regional Australia because of what it signifies. It really would signify that, you know, the government is considering regional Australia with the same level of seriousness that they apply to matters of foreign policy, strategic policy, defence policy.
One of the other recommendations was looking at decentralisation. Did the committee come up with any ideas that might lend itself to decentralisation working and being successful?
Look, the committee, I think, took a very measured approach to decentralisation, and that in itself is a real achievement because it's a very difficult issue, and over the last couple of years it's been highly political. You know, the simple fact that the committee members managed to agree and there was no dissenting minority report is a really positive sign, I think. The committee's report did deal with decentralisation, but it placed it very much within the context of bigger strategic thinking about each region. So essentially what the committee members said was, yes, decentralisation may be advantageous for particular regions of Australia, but we'll only know that when each region has done the strategic planning for its own economic development and is then able to hold conversations about whether luring public or private sector jobs to the region, is it advisable, desirable or achievable.
Dr. Amanda Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, thanks.
ABC Australia Wide.
When the fire came through, it was just like a ball of flame, basically.
On ABC Radio.
Communities dealing with contamination from toxic firefighting foam have launched a national coalition today. PFAS chemicals were used in firefighting foams at defence bases around Australia for decades. They've now been phased out, but the residents living near those bases are having now to deal with the fallout of contaminated soil and groundwater. So the idea is that by forming a coalition, it could force the government to clean up those sites or push for compensation. Diane Priddle runs a cattle stud near the town of Oakey in Queensland's Darling Downs, and she's had first-hand experience with PFAS. Diane, can you paint a bit of a picture about what that contamination has actually meant for you at your property?
Well, I guess 4 years of nightmare. When you wake up one day, you go to bed one night and you've got an asset base. You wake up the next morning and you haven't got an asset base. And then on top of that, you've got your life's work in a mess. And then on top of that, you've got health issues that may be caused from this chemical.
Do you know exactly what the PFAS may have done to your land?
No, look, all I can say is this, that in our community, Defence has put a 26-kilometre boundary around Oakey, and that depicts our life. That boundary has three different sites, and it all varies, I guess, but it doesn't matter, in my opinion, the degree that it varies. The answer is this. We have contamination. It's called PFAS. The global community tells us it's not great to have. Our government tells us something different. And I say this to people. If you have enough questions, wouldn't you err on the side of caution?
What action have you already taken and your community has already taken?
Look, as an individual, David and I are primary producers of stud Charolais, Chardonnay and Brahman here at Oakey. We have had the Prime Minister to our farm. We've had the task force here four times. David and I went to Canberra, spoke with the coalition, spoke with opposition, spoke with crossbenchers. We have also lobbied community, lobbied our local members. I think for us personally, the only thing left once more sites come on board is what we've done today, and that is launch caps. And you know, with when you can inform and advocate and connect communities that are caught up in this contamination like we have been for 4 years and still haven't got the answer, and act as a national voice, we would hope that it will highlight to local communities what's happening globally, and then in turn, as a national voice, can put pressure where it's required to get a different outcome for all of Australia with the government.
And if this coalition does prove to have a little bit more sway, particularly with government, what are the main things that you want to achieve?
Well, I guess the first thing is that we want the government to look at the international and global data that is saying something very different to their outdated science that they're using. And then I guess the second thing is that we would hope that, like they promised in their election campaign, both sides of the political party, that they would deal with acquisition or compensation or whatever the term you want to call it. That is 3 years down the track and that hasn't happened. We've had Senate inquiries where recommendations were, some have been done, but that main key sticking point of dealing with the people that live in this mess hasn't been addressed by the government of the day. And we need that to change. Because I say this to people that are just starting to be informed that they may have PFAS or they're starting to understand about PFAS. If you had this in your life, would you want it to take 4 years and still counting and we have not been dealt with? When you've lost everything you've worked for your life, you've got questions on your health, you've got questions on your community. Would you want your government, the Australian government, to take this long to act upon it? If I was your mother or your grandmother, if this was your house, your backyard, would you think this is good enough? And I'm sure the answer is it's not good enough. So maybe if it was in the Prime Minister's back door, it was in every minister in Australia's household or their backyard, that they may have a different approach to this.
Diane Priddle, thank you so much for sharing your story and your experience with us today.
Thank you very much, Bridget, for having me.
Diane Priddle runs a cattle stud with her partner David Jeffress in Queensland's Darling Downs, and they are representatives of the Coalition Against PFAS, or CAPS, which was launched today. This is Australia Wide. My name's Bridget Fitzgerald. Along Australia's east and west coasts, humpback whales are on the move for their annual migration, and census data released today shows a 10% increase in humpback populations nationally compared to last year. For coastal towns like Byron Bay, these giants of the sea bring valuable tourist dollars. But as Eloise Farrow-Smith reports, originally the whales were the backbone of Byron's local economy for a very different reason.
Oh, that's our first baby humpback for the season. New calf for 2018 that we've seen here. Probably at least 10 to 14 days old.
Seasoned whale watcher Alison Reid explains how to spot a whale at sea.
You have to have expert eyes and a good pair of binoculars today. But anywhere from the headland out to the horizon, we count. We mark it from the fence line out to the horizon is 12 o'clock, the straight line. And as they cross over that line, that's when we tally them down.
But in the 1950s, it was the dead whales which brought onlookers.
Especially weekends there, you couldn't walk in around Byron Bay up that back road to the other meatworks. There's that many people and cars there, and there were people there just standing there riding back to the road, and they're just watching the other meatworks working, and that then out in the jetty all the time watching the whales come in. You could hardly walk out that way then.
That's 83-year-old Cole Smith. He worked as a flenser at the Byron Whaling Company from 1953 to 1962.
My job was on the bottom deck. I never went out in the boat at all. They had a special crew. They moved out from Ballina to go out and catch the whales and deliver them to the other jetty at Byron Bay. And then we'd haul them in with a little train, then pull them off onto the bottom deck. And my job was just to cut them up into bigger pieces, then hauled up, cut into small pieces, and they were cooked up into a big boiler down the bottom below the top deck, and then that was all separated into oil. Hard stuff was sort of cooked up again, and it was made into fertiliser.
In the 50s, jobs were scarce in Byron Bay, and the whales provided a regular income.
Especially around Byron Bay there, because there was only the meatworks was more or less there, and Norco. And Zirk and Rutile, those were about the only ones that was there. And, or otherwise you had to go away somewhere to find work. So the ones that were worked there, they were pleased to get there. As I say, it was a job, you know, and, you know, people didn't seem to worry about it. There was plenty of whales swimming up there, you know, and they didn't sort of worry. Then they said, oh, well, it's another job. People can get work. But when they sort of started different, you know, disappear, that's when people started to think, oh, well, gee, we don't want to kill them out, you know, it's a good sightseeing place. Well, even while the whaling was going, it brought thousands of people into Byron Bay.
When volunteers began counting whales, it was hard work. Tiffany Lee from Orca says it's a different story today.
A long time ago, when the whales were in really, really, really low numbers, that it was actually a census month, and they were counting like 40 in a month, whereas these days we can count up to 190, 200 whales in a day.
She says attitudes have changed, but whales continue to be the backbone of Byron Bay's tourism.
It was how this town got a major part of its income, and now this town still gets a major part of its income, but on the absolute other side of the coin.
This year's National Humpback Whale Census confirms the whale population is bigger than ever. The count took place at sites from West Australia to the New South Wales coast, with 2,257 sightings on census day. That's up almost 10% on last year. Good news for the whales and those who love to watch them.
It's Some delighted sounds there. Thanks to Eloise Farrow-Smith with that report from Byron Bay. Let's head to the West Australian Wheat Belt now, where two mates have put their retirement on hold to save their local watering hole. The Mininew Hotel, 400 kilometres north of Perth, is in need of more than just a lick of paint. But as Jessica Hayes reports, Terry Brennan and Adrian Burns are up to the challenge.
Why buy a country pub?
We like the town. We like the people. Are fantastic. It has a very good trading history. I know pubs are different these days, but, you know, I think if you put on good meals, good company, good drinks, people will come and enjoy themselves.
Since purchasing the historic building in December, the men have been restoring the pub to its former glory with their own hands and the help of bar manager Trevor Sampson.
Now, you're obviously young pups, but edging towards what some would say is retirement age, some would argue. Why take on this challenge?
Well, the challenge, I've been in building all my lifetime, and the challenge of resurrecting an old pub, that's been a good one. We know we nearly finished it, but we're having fun doing it.
I think it's the busiest I've ever been in my life, actually. Yeah, I still trade in a few sheep. Yeah, this on top of that makes it 7 days a week job. But what else do you do?
So retirement is not an option for you?
No, no, I really don't know what it means myself. I guess I'll have to one day when you know, can't do it anymore. But while you can do it, I can't see why we don't all do it. You know, like 65 these days is not old. You know, I think it's a silly retirement age myself.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, just, as I say, I went out from building, retired from building and went in the pub game. So, you know, it's a whole new career at 65.
The restoration has involved the rebuild of the hotel's kitchen, as well as the installation of new floors, ceilings, benches and plumbing across 35 rooms. The men say the physical labour is challenging, but 12-hour days are fun when you're working alongside your mates.
Three friends who are all coming together and doing this. You're doing this work yourselves, these renovations?
Yeah, we've done pretty much everything except electrical and plumbing. But everything else has been done, even making cabinet. We had the cabinet maker in this morning, that was Burnsy, and the painter followed him, and that was me. Trev was making the sandwiches.
For bar manager Trevor, the local pub is the heart of any country town, and he hopes it will bring back a sense of community to the town.
If you take the pub out of the town, it doesn't kill the town, but the town lacks something from that day on when it's shut. There's less people pulling in, pulling out, and it just doesn't affect us, it'll affect every other business in town as well.
An opening date for the pub has not yet been decided, and they're still finalising their perfect palmy recipe. But they are confident if the beer's good, the people of Mininew will come.
Now, biggest question, how do we decide what beers you're going to have on tap? Who got to... Was there a taste testing process?
Well, fairly experienced at the taste testing. But it's a matter of the popular beers.
I think you can hear the experience there in Terry Brennan's voice speaking there to Jessica Hayes. And you can see photos of those lovely fellas up on the ABC News website. And here with the latest news of this evening is Australia Wide's Lucy Bell with an update on a northern prawn farm, I believe.
Yeah, that's right, Bridget. Brisbane-based company AAM Investment Group has released a statement to the stock exchange confirming its intention to buy Lejeune Station on the WANT border. Now, Lejeune is a cattle property, but it's also the planned home of Project Sea Dragon, a 10,000-hectare prawn farm by a company called Sea Farms. The two businesses have reached an agreement to work together, the plan being that AAM Investment Group would run the cattle side of the business while leasing the land on Lejeune back to Sea Farms for their $1.5 billion prawn project. So, Bridge, AAM Investment Group now has until the end of September to secure the necessary funds to buy Lejeune. So watch this space.
And a project that's been coming for a long time. And, Lucy, just quickly, I believe some exciting news about koalas.
Yeah, of course, Bridget. Didn't want to leave this one out. An Australian-led team of scientists has mapped the genome of the koala, which is no mean feat because the blueprint contains more than 26,000 genes, and they've found some really important ones in there too. Really big step for conservation.
Excellent news. Thank you so much, Lucy Bell. And thank you for your company this evening. My name's Bridget Fitzgerald. It's been an absolute pleasure to be with you. I'll be back tomorrow. Enjoy your evening.